Hey, deserving listeners, it's just me today. I thought I would answer upper tier patron emails. This first email is from upper tier patron Alyssa from Los Angeles. She writes, what schema would you speculate this as? Due to glass child syndrome, all right, just chiming in here, she's saying that she has glass child syndrome, and I had to look this up on the internet, and apparently it is glass children are siblings of a person with a disability. So the word glass means that people tend, the caregivers, parents tend to see right through the glass child because they're taking care of the other child with a disability. All right. So Alyssa says, due to glass child syndrome, I have an inherent belief from young childhood that my mere existence is a burden to everyone around me if I ever express any of my needs. So I am wholly focused on fulfilling everyone else's needs. I looked up a list of common schemas and was unsure of how it would be classified. I am in therapy and working on it, but I was just curious. End of email. Yeah, so I like this game of identify the schema. And although let's explore what schemas we might categorize it within the standard theory of schema therapy put forth by Jung. But when I work with clients, I don't necessarily slot them into one of these 18 schemas. I just stick to the language that the client is using. So for you, Alyssa, I would just call this I am a burden schema, because that fits closer to home than whatever sort of category we might put you in, because those are your words. And I would also have the schema of I'm here to fulfill everyone else's needs. That's the way you're phrasing it. Butler syndrome is what Bob calls it. You know, there's no schema called Butler syndrome, but for Bob, it fits that that's the word that he uses, you know. So, but if we were to slot it into the different schemas, off the top of my head, it sounds like you might be a candidate for schema number 3, which is emotional deprivation, or what I call people don't care about me. And the items that one would agree with if one has the schema would be the following. I've never had a consistent person to depend on for advice and emotional support. Generally speaking, no one has ever really been there to meet my emotional needs. I haven't gotten enough love and nurturance from others. For most of my life, I've never been someone's main relationship. For most of my life, I have not had someone who really cares to listen or understand me. So those are items that if you agree with most of those significantly, then you might be categorized as someone who suffers from what I call the people don't care about me. People don't care about me schema. But I would also perhaps just use your words, which is I am a burden, you know, which kind of summarizes it. The other schema that you are describing seemingly is what we call self-sacrifice. Maybe self-sacrifice, but also subjugation, or I must please others. So items from this schema, that these are my words, I've adapted Jung's model, but if you agree with some or most of these, it could indicate that this is the schema you're describing when you're saying that you're wholly focused on fulfilling everyone else's needs. I usually let other people have their way because I'm afraid of the consequences. In relationships, I let other people make the decisions. I often don't know what I want. I hate confrontations. If I assert what I want, something bad will happen, that sort of thing. So, yeah, let's go on to more emails. And by the way, if I'm going to actually finish reading everyone's email around this end of the year, beginning of the year, 2023, then I have to go a lot faster. I have to not respond as lengthily to every single email the way I've been doing this week. and the other thing I want to tell you is that if I'm going to try to get to every single email, but I can't get to every single email because I think it would literally take me years, like no joke. So some emails that I think I've already answered, I'm just going to figure that you will know that I answered at least a question that was similar to yours that hopefully addresses your question. The other thing is that I need to revise my expectation, everyone, and I've talked about this before, that I will answer every email. I can't. I need to tell everyone that, you know, consider it like a 50-50 chance that I might get to your email. And that's only if you're an upper tier patron, because I, you know, give preference to that for obvious reasons. If you're a patron, then, you know, maybe it's a 20% chance. And if you're not a patron, then I would give it a pretty low chance, but, you know, a possible chance that I'll get to your email. So I just want to make sure that expectation is out there so that I don't deceive anyone and hurt anyone's feelings. Because, you know, I love the emails. It gives me your questions are so great, and they obviously give me content, and I learn a lot from your questions because I learn, but also I learn like what holes in my explanations I might have had. I always, as a professor, I need questions to tell me what my lectures are deficient in. You know, I want the information to be understood. And if there are questions, then, and of course there will be questions, then that gives me the opportunity to, you know, fully help you to understand what I'm trying to explain, you know? So along these lines, I'm going to try to address all the emails, and I'm going to go through, because I have several documents and there might be literally thousands of emails that I'm going to try to address or at least review to see if I should read on, you know, in this series of episodes going on right now. And then at the end of those episodes, I'm going to actually delete everything in my files. And so if you email me a question January, February of 2023, or you emailed me a question in the end of 2022, there's a chance that that email will get sort of swept up in this process, because starting in March-ish 2023, I just want to start with a completely clean slate. I don't want a single email that is left in my documents, because I have that compulsive need. You know, I'm one of those people that likes to get to inbox zero. I want to be email Psychology in Seattle zero at some point. So, because, you know, some of the questions that people have submitted, they might have submitted them like no joke 3 years ago. And I don't hold on to the dates that people will send them in. So these people might not be there's a chance they don't even listen to the podcast anymore. So why should I even read that? So I need to wipe the slate clean. I was thinking about doing this every year, just like answer all the emails I can and then wipe the slate clean, you know, and, you can resubmit a question if you felt like I didn't get to it. All right. This next email is from upper tier patron Jen from Pennsylvania. She writes, "Could you do an episode on compulsive lying, specifically in children? I am very worried about my 10-year-old son. He's always enjoyed lying, as a lot of kids do, to get out of trouble. But as he grows, I notice he lies about literally everything. Even if there are no supposed consequences, he will still lie. Even though he sees me witness the truth, he will lie anyway and lie and not admit it. And his biological father was like this too, but my son has never known him. So what could be causing this pathological lying? We don't typically lie in our family, and anytime our kids witness a white lie, we tend to discuss it with them and admit it's wrong. We also aren't very strict, and we won't spank or shout as a consequence when he does something wrong. It's killing me because I can't understand his motivation to lie so much. Thanks so much for considering my question to be on your show." End of email. Yeah. So you're good to point out, based on other statements that I've said, that there are the common reasons that kids will compulsively lie, pathologically lie, and you describe it well, that they will lie about a lot of things. They will lie even when it doesn't serve them. They will lie even when it is completely illogical to do so. You know, when you everyone knows, including them, that you know that they're lying, they will continue to lie. It's something that people, including kids and adults, will do, and the reasons for it usually are because it served them when they were young to get out of trouble. They were being abused, or there was some kind of terror involved, and they just learned to, as a knee-jerk reaction, lie because it saved their life or helped them to survive. And so there's no checks and balances. There's no editor. They just automatically lie, and they have tremendous anxiety when they think they're about to be in trouble. And it's a distortion. You could almost consider it like a mini personality disorder. And it takes a long time to change, especially. And also there's a habitual nature to it as well. The neurological pathways become very strong. The lying neurological pathways become very strong, and thus are more likely to engage when the opportunity or the situation arises. So, but you're good to point out that you're saying, look, we're not very strict and we don't spank or shout at our kids. And we also don't lie ourselves. So we aren't modeling lying to the kids. And he doesn't have any reason to lie to get out of trouble or something. So I don't understand. But you also point out that his biological father, who he hasn't had any contact with, also lied a lot. So is it genetic? And the answer is we don't know, because we don't know anything about the cause of human behavior as individuals. But it's possible that, so there's a few possibilities. One is that it's just a phase. Kids go through phases. And if you have enough kids or you've been around enough kids, you know that. On the other hand, there are things that often will become mainstays in one's personality. Like there's a chance that this lying behavior will just naturally go away as they just learn how to not do it, because there's a lot of natural consequences to lying to you, to classmates, to teachers. You know, they will be rejected because of it. They will be potentially humiliated. People will make fun of them, or people will point it out, like, you can't do that. Or they'll be punished twice as long. You know, there's a lot of real consequences, social and otherwise, that will happen to him regardless of what you do. I'm guessing you're also doing consequences to him, right? At the very least, I was trying to convince him not to lie and giving him the impression that you would love him, or not love him, but that you would be more proud of him, I guess, if he be more approval of his behavior if he were not to lie. That's probably a better phrase. Anyway, so there's a chance that he'll just grow out of it, and kids sometimes just go through phases. There's also a chance that regardless of anything that anyone does, he will continue to do this into adulthood. We, in the United States, I think in particular, we have in certain circles, we have this notion that somehow you have the power as a parent to shape your child's personality and behavior and patterns. And that's good that you believe that, because you take responsibility for the parts that you do have responsibility for and do have an effect on. But I've been around the block enough times and been with enough kids and families to understand that kids are independent human beings with their own personalities, their own decisions, their own volition, their own development, their own point of view. And you can try to change it, and you should try to change it. If your 10-year-old kid, for example, just dedicates himself to continuing to do this, you know, he might even believe you. He might even say, yeah, you know what? My mom's right. I probably shouldn't lie. But if he just wakes up in the morning and says, but I don't care, that's up to him. He can make that choice. So do what you can do, but also just recognize that the notion that somehow you have complete control over the molding of your child is a false one. Anyone who has like a 30-year-old child that has difficulties understands this, you know. In fact, a lot of the times when people have kids that they're really proud of, I often just think, well, to some extent, you just rolled the dice and the dice came up well for you, because you could have easily rolled the dice in a different way. And I'm not talking about just genetics. You know, they're human beings. Your 10-year-old son is a fully fledged human being with his own brain, his own personality, and his own decision-making process. He has his own free will. He can decide to do what he wants to do. And if, anyway, but there's another possibility that it is largely genetic. Not, you know, lying isn't necessarily genetic, but fear of consequences, fear in general is seemingly somewhat genetic, like your propensity to be afraid. There's people who are born seemingly with a high degree of propensity to fear, and people in the average and people at the low end of the spectrum. And to some extent, getting in trouble and social rejection will cause fear in the child, such that they will learn from their mistakes and try to avoid that in the future. And if the child doesn't feel much fear in general, then it takes a lot longer for them to learn a lesson, for example, to not lie. Also, there seem to be some genetic components to empathy for other human beings. And it's possible that he, and you didn't include this in the email, it's possible that he generally just doesn't really care, doesn't really connect with other people. The other possibilities is that although you think you're not providing some sort of fear in him regarding telling the truth, he might actually be experiencing it, either because you're unaware of how you're coming across, which, you know, let's just say that's not likely the case, but, you know, it's possible. I've been with enough families to know that's true. also, it's possible that the way you parent might have actually in the past made your kid feel afraid, even though most kids wouldn't react that way. You know, you can parent your kid really well and your kid just interprets it in this really wildly odd manner. And that's why it's important to kind of monitor those things, see how they're reacting. But yeah, let's just say that that's probably also not it. Other things that could have happened was when children have early childhood attachment disruption, you know, I don't know, Jen, but you know, depending on who was taking care of him 0 to 2 years old, primarily, and their mood and their capacity for attunement, you know, maybe someone was depressed or anxious or overworked, or, you know, they had an illness or something that can affect the child's connection with other human beings. And sometimes the a side effect or a symptom of lack of general connection with other human beings can be compulsive lying. And I've seen that before as well. I'll see it in adoption and this kind of thing. Doesn't sound like there's any evidence of that. So I don't know. There's a lot of other possibilities as well. He could be experiencing things at school that are causing this, you know, that's out of your awareness to some extent, out of your control to some extent. Also, you might be framing it as compulsive lying when it actually is kind of maybe just a little bit above average lying, right? Like to you, maybe you grew up without very much lying going around. And so maybe he has slightly above average lying and it's very alarming to you. You're just like, it's very foreign to you and it's not actually in the category that I would say is concerning, right? So these are all reasons why you should go to a family therapist, someone who knows about these kinds of things. You can really assess this and try to figure out how to address it. All right, this next email is from anonymous upper tier patron. She says, would you please talk about intuition versus projecting? My intuition alone has saved me more than once, and I really believe it is a useful tool to use, especially in potentially dangerous situations. I'm concerned that by you recommending trying to be too differentiated, we could dismiss completely something valid that our gut is trying to tell us. I think some of your series show how difficult it can be to separate genuine helpful intuition from unhelpful and unfair projection, and I'd love it if you could talk about that a bit more. End of email. Yeah, so it's a great question. Of course, it's hard to tell, and maybe I don't emphasize this enough. But absolutely, intuition, I mean, what do we mean by intuition? It's really important to identify that because on one hand, intuition is our ability to pick up on data. When I'm talking with a client, a lot of the data that the client is presenting is not registering with me super consciously. Like when I'm talking with a new client and I start to get this feeling in my gut and my torso that I'm afraid of the client, I'm afraid of making a mistake in the first session, often that is a red flag or a yellow flag at the very least for someone who has a personality disorder of some kind. And I've learned that over time, that when it's a very specific fear I feel, not only with these clients, but along those lines, when I run into people in my personal life and I get that same exact feeling in my chest, then I sometimes wonder what's going on. You know, does this person have a perceptual problem that's leading them to have subtle hostilities towards me and I'm picking up on them and I'm afraid of them? That's why I'm having this feeling. And then, of course, I have all these thoughts that sort of generate from that fear, like get away from this person or try to please them or I'm screwing up or I'm not a good therapist. Or, you know, those are the thoughts that generate from that emotion. So we could call that intuition. I don't call that intuition. I mean, maybe I would sometimes, but really what I'm talking about is I am picking up on, I'm observing data consciously or subconsciously that is giving me reason to feel as though there's a threat. My perceptions are causing my nervous system to feel like this person will harm me somehow. And then I start to feel afraid. And then my body feels a certain way. And then I notice that. So would we call that intuition? Or would we call that picking up on data? You know, I don't know. Now, another definition or usage of the word intuition is when people are talking about like psychic energies or something. Like one might have an intuition that there will be a hurricane tomorrow when you're not a meteorologist, or One could have an intuition that aliens will land in New York City next year and will make themselves known. You know, that some people might call that an intuition. There's no data to have that conclusion. You're just basically, you have a gut feeling or a hunch, and it's a fantasy that might actually come true because you might just be coincidentally predicting something that will happen. But it's not observable by science. It's not even really likely that it is a mechanism of that's real, confirmation bias, all that kind of thing. So, and there's a lot of things in between, right? There's a lot of usages of the word intuition in between. But to be clear, that when I have what I would call my intuition, I guess, I never take it at face value. I'm never just like, oh, I have fear, thus this client that I don't know that much about has a personality disorder or has borderline or something. I never do that. I always will be skeptical to a great degree. I'm like, well, maybe I just have indigestion, or maybe I'm just making something up, or maybe I'm afraid of something else, or maybe this person is just kind of mildly threatening and it doesn't have anything to do with a personality disorder. I don't know. Maybe they're afraid of me for some weird reason and they're being hostile. You know, there's just a lot of possibilities. And so you always have to wonder if you are quote unquote projecting. It's not actually projection. It's distorting or displacing or transference or something, technically speaking. And so you always have to be differentiated. You always have to have a question mark. You can't take your gut feeling or even your conclusions based on data in a psychological sense, because it's such a squishy form of science. You can't ever take it at face value. You always have to have a question mark around it. Now, at some point, you have to take action, right? As a therapist, like for me, I can never know. Like, let's say that I believe that someone has preoccupied attachment. And let's say I even propose that to the client, describe it, and the client says, yes, I think I do have preoccupied attachment. Do I know scientifically 100% sure that the person does indeed have preoccupied attachment? No, I don't know, because the client could be lying to me. The client could be just agreeing with me. I could be distorted. I could misunderstand what the client is trying to tell me. Like there's just a lot of factors that could lead to a false conclusion, an unhelpful conclusion. But at some point, I have to conclude something so I can at least try to treat something, right? If I have no conceptualization, then I don't know what I'm doing. I need to have some idea about what I should be treating. And so even though I'm not 100% sure, I'm operating from the educated guess based on data and confirmation and collaboration with the client that this is likely what is wrong, or at least one of the things that we need to be working on. And so let's proceed. And then if the treatment actually helps the client. Now, here's the other thing. Let's say that I proceed with the treatment based on preoccupied attachment. And then like 10 weeks later, the client tells me that the treatment has helped them and the conceptualization must have been right. I still can't know if any of it is right because the client could be lying to me. The client could be deluded. The client could be trying to please me. The client could have never had preoccupation, or if they did, they could be just trying to tell me that the treatment is working. I don't know. I'm not there. I'm not with them. And it's a subjective thing anyway. So in psychology, when we think about this question, as you're posing it, intuition versus projection or, displacement or distortion, there's just no way to know. And thus you should always have a question mark. And that's what differentiation is the ability to look at yourself and your conclusions, your bias, your emotions, and go, I don't know. Let's ask some questions. At some point, I might have to operate. Like, let's say you're saying that your intuition alone has saved you in some dangerous situations. So I don't know, but let's say that you're on a date with someone and your intuition is telling you that this guy is dangerous. And so you decide to end the date early and you go home. And then later that night, he texts you and he's threatening to you and is abusive. And you're just like, ooh, dodge that bullet. I didn't have any real reason to believe he was abusive, but I must have been picking up on something. Okay. So on one hand, you could frame it as some sort of psychic intuition, some sort of gut feeling based on some supernatural thing. That's fine. You could also, the way I would frame it is you were picking up on personality and behavioral cues that reminded you of people in the past, or at least to some extent that gave your body enough reason to conclude that there was a danger there, or he was being legit hostile and Maybe his hand movements were a little more aggressive, or his tone of voice, or the things he decided to say in the moment, they weren't like overtly aggressive or controlling, but they had sort of elements of it. And your body was picking up on those data, but it was kind of out of your awareness. And then as time went on, you just had this growing fear. And by the time you noticed the fear, you hadn't really known that you were cataloging a lot of data points to give you that fear. And then you went home. So what do we call that, right? In that moment, you could, so you're in the car and you're getting a gut feeling, and you're like, I think this guy's dangerous. I should go home. Okay. So differentiation in that moment, means that you look at yourself and have a question mark. But I want everyone to understand this, because a lot of times when people understand Bowenian theory, they walk away with this false notion that when you look at your emotions, you're supposed to discount them and not pay attention to them. No. Differentiation is the ability to differentiate and see different parts of your guidance system, the emotional guidance system in your reasoning. And a large part of that is you have the ability to look at each of them and see them as separate. So you see your gut feeling, you're in the car with him, and you're like, I'm having a gut feeling. And you look at it and you take a few seconds to think, do I have any data? Do I have any reason as to why I'm feeling afraid of this guy? I'm picking up on something. So that's differentiation, the ability to just kind of look at it for a second. And let's say that you can't answer that question. You're like, yeah, I don't know. There's really no data there. I can't remember him doing anything that was overtly aggressive. So differentiation is that ability. Now, what do you do from there? Well, on one hand, someone who will bastardize Bowenian theory will say, if you look at the feeling and you don't have any reason to have the feeling, then you need to discount the feeling. No. So you could, a truly differentiated person in that moment, as I'm describing it, would say, I'm having a gut feeling of fear. I can't think of any reason why I would have this fear. But when I zoom out and differentiate from the entire situation and look down on it, I don't need to stay on this date with this guy. And if he's a good guy, he'll let me go home and I'll reevaluate and I can think about it and maybe we'll have a second date later. There's no reason why I have to stay with this guy, because, you know, another feeling I'm having is I don't want to hurt his feelings and I don't want to be mean to him. I don't want to be seen as a jerk face. Okay, I'm having that feeling of that guilty feeling of rejecting him. Well, let me differentiate from that and say, is that rational in this moment? No, because if he's going to be that butthurt by me wanting to, you know, end the date a little early, then, you know, I don't want to date him anyway. So I'm going to differentiate from that feeling. The other thing is, what about another feeling I'm having of like, well, what if I screw this up? You know, what if I, go home and I end up rejecting this guy and everything falls apart and it's because I did it again. I'm a failure at dating again. All right, let me differentiate from that feeling and say, well, the stakes are so high. Like, what if my gut is right? What if I have been picking up on some subtle clues that this guy is abusive? And I guilt myself into staying because I'm so desperate to find a partner. And plus, like, me ending the date earlier doesn't mean that we won't be able to connect later on if I conclude that my gut feeling wasn't warranted. So when I differentiate and recognize all my feelings, even though I have no data to back up this gut feeling of fear I have, I'm going to go the fuck home. And when I do so, you know, I'll reevaluate because there's no emergency here. And that's differentiation, right? It's the ability to look at your feelings, to reason, and to make a choice that is best for you based on all the things. An undifferentiated person would, there's a lot of different things that they would do. One is, as soon as they felt fear, they would run out the door or they would accuse him of being abusive. You know, like, you're being abusive. When there's no data there that he's being abusive. Possible that you just have indigestion or something, or that you're, something about him is just reminding you of a past partner that was abusive, but this person is not abusive. another version of an undifferentiated person is to go home, to stay with the person and to guilt themselves into staying, even though their gut wants them to leave. So undifferentiation isn't not listening to your gut. A differentiated person, I want to be clear, a differentiated person pays attention to their emotions. They listen to their intuition or whatever you want to call it. They listen to their gut. They value it. They just don't automatically go with it. That's the key. They might decide to go with it because they have the ability to look at it. They have the ability to reason about it. And the scenario that I laid out, if I were in that situation and I were differentiated, and maybe I wouldn't be, but if I were, I would reason the stakes are too high to stay. I don't have data to back up this gut feeling, but it's the consequences are far too great for me to stay. I don't need to stay, so I'm going home. And I might be listening to a gut feeling that is wrong, but better safe than sorry, because I don't want to be harmed. I don't want to be stuck in a car with an abusive person. You know, that would be a horrible situation. I don't know this person. I'm going home. So that's my version of a very differentiated person. All right, let's take a break. We'll get back more emails. All right, this next email is from anonymous upper tier patron. She writes, is it actually possible for someone to fall in love with themselves? End of email. Yeah, it's called auto-romanticism or auto-romantic, and there's also auto-sexuality. And some consider it to be a part of the asexual spectrum, the ace spectrum. And basically, it's defined as someone who is either romantically or sexually oriented toward themselves. And although that might sound very pathological and problematic, it's not. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Bottom line, we really need to reduce the stigma for everyone on the ace spectrum, whether it's asexuality, aromanticism, autosexual, autoromantic, demisexual. We need to reduce stigma for it all, because it's not a problem. It's not some scary, weird, crazy, scary thing. It's just, you know, it's fine, right? What's the difference? What's it to you if someone is sexually attracted only to themselves or only wants to be romantic with themselves? It's like, doesn't harm you. So, you know, let it go, people. All right. This next email is from upper tier patron Jasmine. She writes, are psychosomatic symptoms delusions? I recently fell down a rabbit hole learning about Morgellons disease. I found a documentary from a few years ago called Skin Deep, The Battle of Morgellons. And there were a lot of people claiming the disease was only psychosomatic and a result of delusions. It appears to me that it could be considered more of a somatic OCD type thing than a delusion. Is there a clear difference, or could symptoms of somatic OCD be defined as delusional as well? End of email. Yeah, so first off, in our field, we tend to use different words than psychosomatic. Psychosomatic, I don't know when that was introduced, but I remember using that term when I was a kid. So I think at some point our field adopted a different term. The terms that we tend to use are just plainly somatic or psychogenic or conversions. There are other words as well, but essentially what we're talking about when we talk about Morgellons disease, and I'm not an expert, but from what I understand, it's people will have, they'll come into their physician and they'll have rashes and skin irritation, and they'll report feeling as though there are bugs eating their skin. And that, you know, they'll say like, I have this, look at this rash. And, you know, want a diagnosis and want treatment. And then the physician will conduct tests and find that there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with the skin. There's no identifiable issue. And the conclusion will be that the client suffers from some sort of mental disorder. And how do we classify it? Well, Morgellons disease is one of the classifications. Other people might classify it as a somatic issue, meaning that stress or trauma or something, delusions are causing skin rashes, either because the person is scratching it a lot, either when they're awake or when they're asleep, and that's causing the rash. Or you can literally just cause stress-induced physical symptoms. You know, we tend to think of like, well, if the person has a rash, it certainly can't be a psychogenic or a conversion issue, because you can see the rash. You can measure it. You can look at the rash under a microscope and see that there's, inflammation and there's issues there. It can't possibly be generated in the mind, and that's not true. We can generate a lot of problems in the mind. You know, and I won't go into all the science on it because it's not really my area, but I know enough to know that one can, through stress or even just being obsessed with skin rashes, develop skin rashes, like measurable skin rashes. So there's that. And the other thing I'll say is that if you know anything about science and medicine, you understand that we do not know everything about medicine now. In 2023, we know a lot of things, but we do not know everything. And so there are a lot of conditions that are currently classified as psychogenic or a patient just overly complaining that in 100 years, they will say, no, those people were actually suffering from a thing that they just didn't have the ability to detect. You know, they didn't know what to look for. They didn't know how to figure this out. So, but we don't know. Now, it's possible that Morgellons disease and all the people who complain in this area, that none of them have a legit, so to speak, physical issue that is, you know, invasive to their body. But we just don't know. It's just a big question mark, right? We don't know what we don't know. So there's that. But what you're asking is there a clear difference between what one would call Morgellons disease or OCD or delusions? So the word delusion is, and even the umbrella of OCD, it just depends on your definition of it, because you're right to possibly connect OCDs with delusions, because some manifestations of OCD are definitely what you could call delusional. I mean, there are people who will, you know, they'll just be walking down the street and believe that there are germs just falling all over them and they need to bleach their entire body, and they can sense the germs all over them. And there's also versions of OCD where someone believes that God is going to kill them if they don't pray 10 times a day. There's no evidence to support that, but they just believe it. You know, it sounds delusional, and you could categorize it as such, but we categorize it as OCD instead. In the past, we might have categorized it as schizophrenia or a delusion. Are psychosomatic symptoms delusions? They can be, and it depends on your definition. That's how I'll answer it. But it doesn't really matter how we define it, right? It matters what it means for treatment, right? So with people who have psychogenic issues like this, if the conclusion is, because you can never know, like I said, someone comes in with a rash, they complain they have bugs, and you try to talk to them and they're just like convinced that they have bugs, and they're convinced they have some sort of massive problem with their skin. And you run a bunch of tests, and the consensus is there's likely some sort of psychogenic issue here, maybe some sort of OCD-related thing or something. And so you go with that conceptualization, you start to treat them, then you stop applying actual creams that can cause side effects that would be bad for them, right? Because a lot of medications and creams have side effects that aren't welcomed. Instead, you might just prescribe just a general lotion, over-the-counter lotion or something, and then you do psychotherapy, and the therapist, who might have an expertise in this area, starts to explore traumas, start to explore their automatic thoughts, their overall stress level, their sleep, their drug use, because sometimes, you know, people can use, methamphetamine or cocaine, and they can it can exacerbate, even cause this kind of delusion or this kind of disorder of psychogenic worries about these sorts of things. And so you start to treat those things, and over time, as you treat those things, the Morgellons disease or the concern about the rash and the literal rash goes away. And you don't know, but you could conclude pretty strongly, but you'll never know for sure, that you were dealing with someone who did not have what one would consider to be a functional problem with their skin, meaning that there were bugs on their skin or there was some sort of allergic reaction, or, you know, there wasn't anything like that. It was truly psychogenic as a result of their traumas or OCD or something. And by treating the stress and the trauma and the automatic thoughts and the relaxation, addressed it. And more so in the past, there were a lot of people who had similar issues, what we called conversions, where someone would go blind or they would go numb or they become paralyzed or they wouldn't be able to speak. And it was psychogenic. And no matter what you did, the person legitimately could not feel below their waist, or they legitimately could not see anything. It wasn't just fakery. It was totally legit. And by helping them with their trauma or their grief or their attachments or listening to their feelings, it alleviates the core issue, and thus the conversion of the stress into blindness or numbness went away. We don't see that so much anymore in Western society, but we still see it around the world. And the idea is that as society changes its idea of what pathology or the manifestation of pathology changes, then conversions change, meaning that you'd be hard-pressed to find a contemporary Western, you know, cultural person, a contemporary American who even knows about numbness as a result of stress or blindness because of stress. But 100 years ago in the States, most people did know about these kinds of things because it was more prevalent. So the idea goes is that as the human experiences stress, subconsciously, the human in their nervous system will manifest that stress in a way that they hope will be interpreted as stress. You know, think of it like there's a person inside of them going, I'm stressed out, I'm stressed out, I'm stressed out. Well, we need help, we need help, we need help. Well, the ego steps in the way and says, but you can't ask for help because that means you're weak. And so the stressed out person is like, well, we need to sneak a message to the outside. And so we know that we heard down the street when Aunt Martha had, you know, temporary blindness that she got a bunch of attention and a bunch of help. So maybe let's try that. So the self subconsciously develops this blindness and actually shuts down the visual system such that the person is legit blind because they suspect they will get the attention and the help that they need. And in other cultures, that's still the case. Whereas today in the United States, that isn't out there. So we have other ways of subverting the ego to get help. There will be, you know, like becoming depressed or drinking too much or losing your job or becoming a QAnon supporter, like legit, you know, that's the idea anyway, because it does seem to manifest differently in different cultures and different times. The prevalence of conversions changes over time. And you're just like, well, it must have to do with culture, right? Because it's not like genetically we're different than we were before, you know, really. So there must be something that's getting into the subconscious and causing this manifestation to happen. And you could argue that Morgellons disease is another one of those things, that the individual needs help, but because the ego gets in the way and says, no, you can't ask for help or you don't deserve help or something, the body says, well, fuck it, I'll just create this rash. And I will convince the person that there's bugs crawling over them, because surely they will go to the physician then. Someone will look into it and we'll just get some help, and maybe that will cause them to find someone to help us. You know, we don't know exactly who that is, but now, you know, of course, there's a lot of problems with the way I describe that whole thing, but, you know, I hope you get the picture. All right, so let's take a break. And actually, the rest of this episode will just be for patrons of the podcast. So if you want to become a patron of the podcast, you can, and you'll get access to the rest of this episode and all the other episodes, in which are just for patrons. So do so now if you want. All right, welcome to the Patron Zone, patrons. Love you so much. Seriously, love you so much. Let's do an OPP. I want to thank these people for becoming patrons all the way back in 2020 and staying patrons through thick and thin. We have Simon from Ireland, Dublin. We have Jocelyn from Ohio, Sandusky, Ohio. We have Pia from Stockholm, Sweden. We have Megan from Seattle, Washington. Hey, annual patron Megan. Francisca from Zurich. We have Phi from California, BC, Surrey. Been there before. Jessica from Shoreline, Washington. I've been there before, obviously, since it's just down the street from where I live. Tiffany from God knows where. Tempest from Massachusetts. Aaliyah from Madrid. Nicole from California. Katie from North Carolina. Lauren from Georgia. Jennifer from Iowa. Andrew from God knows where. Jennifer is an upper tier patron, by the way. So is Nicole. And so is Francisca. Sorry about that. Sophia is an upper tier patron from Lisbon, Portugal. Dr. Talia is from Toronto. I think I've communicated with you online. Lenny from Prague. Is that Prague? Nick from God knows where. Sonia from Luzern, Switzerland. Lucerne. Rachel from Beaverton, Oregon. Good old Beaverton. Floor and Heather from God knows where. Kelly from Michigan. And Melissa from God knows where. Thank you for becoming a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin. You are the wind beneath my wings, people. All right, next email is from upper tier patron Jasmine. She writes, What is the difference between schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder? You go on in your email to talk about how Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys was originally diagnosed with schizophrenia by Dr. Eugene Landy, and Dr. Eugene Landy exploited Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, if you know about all that. But then later, Brian Wilson was diagnosed with schizoaffective. So you're asking, you know, what's the difference? Well, there's not a huge difference, and some people will have a hard time distinguishing the two. But in a nutshell, schizoaffective is schizophrenia with a mood disorder. That's just kind of generally the description. There's nuances to it. Some people will just, instead of diagnosing someone with schizoaffective, they'll just diagnose them with schizophrenia and a mood disorder. There's also bipolar. They might just call it bipolar with psychosis or bipolar with delusions or something. They might also do that with depression. So it doesn't really matter, because the medication and the treatment regimens are usually really quite similar along these lines. It's more important that the evaluators really fully listen to the client, because sometimes evaluators will hear about or notice delusions and psychosis and just go schizophrenia without really taking the time to get to know how moods might be involved in it. But anyway, all right, the next email is related to the previous one. Anonymous annual upper tier patron from Arizona. She says, is there life after schizophrenia or schizoaffective bipolar subtype misdiagnosis? They go on. A few years ago, I experienced a psychotic break and lived with psychosis every day for about 3 years. I had terrible paranoia, daily suicidal ideation, strange beliefs that I was an alien, and I would swing wildly in mood from high to low and back, etc. It was very difficult, and I knew that I wasn't going to survive long-term with this disorder. But sometimes there were earth-shattering beautiful moments. I felt the highest of highs of euphoria that I could never explain. Art and music were vivid and beautiful like you could never imagine, and I felt like I was a favored child of the sun. It all ended when I was diagnosed with celiac disease. After I went on a gluten-free diet and cut caffeine because I found out I was sensitive, my daily psychosis went away, and I have since lived a normal, boring existence. Life isn't the same, though. I want the euphoria and magic back. I don't like feeling like a human, and I'm not excited about continuing with this mind-numbing existence for the remaining decades. Is this common for people who had their psychosis yanked away from them? What can we do to find joy and wonder again when we know it will never be close to the way it once was? End of email. Yeah, so just so you know, everyone out there, there has been research demonstrating that celiac disease, for a rare percentage, you know, a small percentage of people with celiac, it can result in psychosis, as anonymous annual upper tier patient from Arizona is describing. And when the celiac disease is properly treated, the psychosis goes away completely. The we don't know exactly why, because we don't really understand schizophrenia and the mind at all, really, anyway. But we do know enough to know that the gut and the mind are basically one and the same. I won't go into detail on it, but and it makes sense, because our existence depends on our ability to get food. And that goes way back to the very first organisms that existed on this planet, was the consumption of materials to make energy so that one could, I don't know the exact biological definition, but so that one could survive, so one could reproduce or stay afloat or whatever, you know. So the processing of nutrients and food is critical to survival, obviously, right? And our nervous system and our digestive system developed and evolved hand in hand. You know, they're linked very, very closely. We tend to look at them as very separate things. But my point is that the gut and the mind are well known to be very connected. And not only would we have, when we perceive something and we have like a gut feeling, or we have an emotion and we feel it in our stomach because of that connection, but also when we have disorders of the digestive system, it can to some extent affect our mood and our belief system, and can greatly affect it, as in celiac disease in some people. So what you describe, anonymous annual upper tier patron, is that at, you know, untreated celiac disease, undiagnosed celiac disease, and your caffeine sensitivity, you developed psychosis and you had Also, you could consider it to be schizoaffective disorder or bipolar with psychosis or something, you know, reference earlier email when I was discussing the, it depends on how you look at it and how you categorize the symptoms. But essentially what you're talking about is you would have low, low depression and you would have high, high mania and you would have psychosis associated with these shifts where when you were low, low depression, you hated yourself and you thought everything was horrible and suicidal ideation and paranoia. And then when you became manic and you were very, very high, you would have moments where you would have deep, deep, deep euphoria that you could never explain, you say, and art and music were vivid and beautiful. And you felt like you were a favored child of the sun. And now that you have had treatment, which is great, and you recognize that that's good, you miss that euphoria. And upper tier patron, let me tell you that almost everyone with bipolar, which you could kind of consider yourself to be a part of that group, has the same lament in that, you know, hypomania and even elements of upper mania, by definition, are euphoric. And you have tremendous confidence and energy and optimism and, you know, the world is your oyster and you're the life of the party, particularly if you're hypomanic. And you're getting things done and people appreciate you and, you know, things just roll off your back and, you know, you just, and when you're properly treated, there's no way to retain hypomania. There's no way to retain the good side of mania. So you have to get rid of the whole thing at this point. Maybe in the future they'll, but God help us if they ever come out with a drug. I mean, essentially we do have a drug that can do that kind of, and it, essentially it's meth and other kinds of drugs like that. But the consequences are so great. But imagine if we had a drug that didn't have the consequences and you could just be manic. I mean, my goodness, I'm just going to take a guess and say that that will happen in the next 500 years and God help the human race if that ever happens. Although maybe it'd be a good thing. I don't know. Anyway. So yeah, I mean, it's a loss. You're grieving that and you're like, how do I get that back? And you're also wondering, should I even live? Is life worth living without it? So on one hand, it's normal to grieve that loss because it is a loss. But I hope you recognize the consequence, and because the risk is that people in your position will go off treatment. So you could, for example, go off your gluten-free diet and start drinking caffeine and try to get it back, but you would be inviting this massive monster into your soul, which is the psychosis, and I'm guessing there's digestive problems, but also the massive suicidal depression, and there's no guarantee that you'll actually even have the euphoria, you know what I mean? So, and often that high is short relative to the suffering of the paranoid delusions and all that kind of stuff. So obviously it's within your interest, very, very, very much so, to not take that risk. And all you people out there who are in this boat of having bipolar or celiac induced bipolar, then, you know, hear my words, stay on your treatment. And if you are starting to question it, make sure you reach out to a support system that can help you, because it's almost like an addiction where people will say like, you know, I can go back to meth. You know, what if I just dabbled in alcohol again? You know, I could have a couple of drinks. And it's like, no, you can't, you know, so don't go off your treatment. Follow your doctor's recommendations. Very important. Some of the worst things that have happened to people have been because they toyed with trying to get all that back. So it's a loss, you know, and it sucks. The other possibility, upper tier patron, is that even though you're getting the treatment that you need, and even though relative to the past, you know, when you were having your episode for 3 years, you are doing a lot better mentally, you might still be kind of depressed. You might actually benefit from further treatment regarding, you know, psychotherapy or medication to help you with, but I don't know, but it's possible that you still have a low-grade depression. Because, you know, things that you say, it's like, I'm not excited about continuing this mind-numbing existence for the remaining decades. So again, it's possible you're depressed. The other possibility is that you just don't know what, it's similar to when people become sober. It's sometimes like your entire life is different and you don't know what to do with yourself. So it's possible that because of everything that was happening to you, you now really don't know what life is. You don't have a foundation of life. You don't have the, I'm guessing your relationships really quite suffered during that time. And you're rebuilding your life. And so there might not be anything to get excited about because you haven't built a life on the other side of this. And so it could just be that you need to build life. Obviously, psychotherapy would be recommended first and foremost. And, you know, like I said, possible consultation for medication. But you deserve to have a fulfilling life. I do not have mania. And I love my life. It's possible to love your life and feel meaning, feel purpose, and feel euphoric, and to see the beauty in a different way. You know, I see the beauty in the world. I experience euphoria. When I listen to music, I'll cry. When I watch movies, I have ups and downs. Recently, I was really, really just tired late at night, and I decided that I thought, well, you know, I'll watch an episode of Modern Family because it's been a while. And on Hulu, it's commercial free. So I think about season 5 was when it really started to get good. And so I started episode 1, season 5. And that show is just so great. Yes, you can criticize it for certain things, you know, particularly when you look back at earlier episodes, but it's so heartfelt, and so the characters are so well realized. The humor is so good, and the messages are so positive, and it's just such the humanness of it. It's so good. And so I'm watching it and I'm crying and I'm laughing and I'm laugh crying. And, I'm just reveling. It's been a number of years since I think the last time I would have watched it seriously would have been the last season, which was a while back. But there's a time when it first came out, I don't know, 20 years ago, when I watched it a lot in those first few seasons. At the time, it was a total, you know, groundbreaking show. Now it's not so groundbreaking, but at the time, I mean, to have a gay couple adopt a kid, and I have to tell you, like, Lily, the adopted Vietnamese girl, into a white family, you know, there's a lot of, they even make racist jokes about her, but not at her expense, really, I would say. Although you could argue some of them are kind of, but as an Asian person, I'm not Vietnamese, but I am Asian, and I am very sensitive to Asian jokes. I'm very sensitive to it. You know, like when Licorice Pizza, and there, if you've seen it, there's this pretty awful set of scenes in which this white guy imitates Japanese people, and you go, also, and I found it to be jarringly, I mean, I really love that movie, but those few scenes are just jarringly racist and awful. Like, even if you make an argument that, well, you know, it's a commentary. They're making fun. And it's like, no, it doesn't play that way to me. And it didn't play that way to many Asian Americans. To many Asian Americans are like, okay, I get you were trying to make fun of a racist, but it just comes across as racist. Like, you know, I love It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And those guys are incredibly racist about a variety of people, including Asians. And when they do that, I think it's hilarious because it's clear who the joke is on. The joke is on the racist. It's not on the Asian. But in Licorice Pizza, it just doesn't play that way. And I don't believe that the writer was trying to be racist and then, you know, retroactively claimed that he was actually trying to make fun of the racist. I think he was legitimately trying to make fun of a racist, but because he doesn't understand how things will come across and possibly is ignorant or racist himself, he fucked it up. It's not good. So I'm very sensitive to that. And so when other people are not, and the jokes again, you know, at Lily's expense, the Vietnamese adopted girl, I still find them to be hilarious. I haven't seen every joke again, you know, through my contemporary eyes. But so anyway, I was having a euphoric experience watching this TV show. And so upper tier, and I wasn't high. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't, you know, manic. I was arguably kind of depressed. I mean, not terribly so, but just kind of like, I'm just going to sit here on the couch and watch. And I watched, no joke, 15 episodes in a row. And I think they're like 17-minute episodes when you cut out all the commercials on Hulu. So I was just burning through episodes. And I had to actually pull myself away from it because it was like 1:30 in the morning. And I was like, yeah, I should probably go to bed. But if I had my druthers, I would have watched another 15 episodes. It's so great. So my point is that you, without you know, mania without psychosis, without drugs, you know, drug-induced euphoria, one can find euphoric, meaningful, wonderful moments. And they won't necessarily feel as euphoric or as elevated as what you might have experienced in the past. But think about the wonderfulness that you get post-treatment. And this is a similar argument, you know, for everyone out there who is recovering from an addiction. You know, it's not all roses, right? When you give up alcohol or meth or heroin or whatever, you are giving it up because of the negative effects it has in your life, but you're also depriving yourself of the positive effects. People use these drugs for the positive effects. The negative effects largely outweigh these positive effects, but you know, that's what you're always searching for. And so you're giving those up, and there's no way to sugarcoat that. You know, people will say, well, you know, there are no positive effects of drugs. And it's just like, well, for some people, but for the vast majority of people, there are positive effects. They use them for those positive effects. And so when you become sober, you gain sobriety. You don't have to deal with the negative effects, but you also will never get back the positive effects. Can you manufacture them kind of without the drugs? Yeah. But sometimes not even close, not entirely. And them's the breaks, because it's all a matter of pros and cons and cost-benefit analysis. You know, you have to have that calculation. And, you know, to talk with other people, they'll sugarcoat it. They'll be like, no, you know, I'm high on life. I can have as much euphoria without drugs, you know, because I'm just high on life. And okay, I can't really measure people's euphoria, but you know, I call BS on that. Because if you've ever been super high or, you know, super euphoric when you're on a substance, there's really nothing like it, right? It's a very unique experience. Not for everyone, of course, but for many, particularly people who become addicted, because that's one of the precursors, one of the causes. It's like, oh my God, I want to feel like that again. So one could argue, and many will report, that there's nothing as good as it was when they were in that state, in that altered state, whether it's by celiac disease or heroin or cocaine or something. And it sucks. It's a loss. You're grieving it. You're never going to get it back unless you invite the monster in and it potentially kills you. So it sucks and it's sad, but it doesn't mean you can't have euphoria. It doesn't mean that you can't have joy and wonder and be dazzled by life. It doesn't mean that at all, you know? It just means you'll never have that particular version of that again, you know? Like for me, with my life, as I get older, I'm dazzled by you who listen and email in and are like me, and you're like-minded. You care about similar things that I do, and the way you put things, I'm dazzled by that. I'm euphoric at the life that I've built with my wife and my family, and my parents are about to come up on their 60th wedding anniversary, and the feeling I get from my parents still married after 60 years and being with my parents and hugging my parents and talking to my parents, and the feeling I get from that, there's no way I could get that feeling from a drug, you know? And it sustains itself. The feeling I get when I am hanging out with my dogs, I could approximate it with a drug, but I could never get the solid ground, meaningful, you know, tangible feeling of interacting with my dogs, you know, the eye contact and the fun we have together and the cuddling we have. And it's incredibly meaningful to me. It's grounded in reality. It involves other creatures, other people that are also experiencing it. You know, when you're using a substance, you're kind of alone in the euphoria, right? It's just this manufactured chemical euphoric feeling that you're having in your brain, isolated from reality. When you're having euphoric, meaningful, important moments with your family, with your friends, with your animals, you know, it's shared, and it's deeper. It's more meaningful, different, and on the scale of things, maybe less euphoric, but I don't know, more sustainable, more meaningful to me, you know. When I'm on my deathbed, I have a feeling I'm not going to look back at my life and wish that I, you know, had manufactured more chemical euphoric experiences at the cost of, you know, the downside of substances, you know. I'm just going to take a guess and say that I'm going to value much more the relationships and the love that I've shared with other people and the meaning that I've had in my life, the purpose that I have enacted, the little bit of, effect that I might have had on a few people's lives, that is the thing. And that's another thing, anonymous patron, is that, it's possible that your celiac disease and your psychotic break might have like really derailed any kind of meaning making or purpose making that you had in your life. And you might be starting from scratch around that as well to build that back up. Because when we're in line with our purpose and we're enacting the meaning of our life, we don't just have a meaning of, we do the meaning of our life. We don't just decide on the meaning of our life. We actually behaviorally act out the meaning of our lives. When we do that, we're in the flow, and it's meaningful. It's deeper. It's important. We have some euphoria, but there's also a lot of strife and adversity. But it's worth it. We're doing something. We're here for a reason. We get up in the morning for a reason, and we go to bed for a reason. We act for a reason. We take care of ourselves for a reason. We put up with the bullshit for a reason, and it's possible that you don't have a reason, and that's okay, and you just might have to build that back up again. So that's my talk on that. All right, this next email is from anonymous patron. They write, "Please, can you talk about intrusive thoughts, what they are, the causes, and some management strategies? I suffer from intrusive thoughts occasionally, and I find that they have gotten worse during the pandemic and working from home as I have less of a distraction. These intrusive thoughts horrify me and range from common ones, like thinking I will jump off of a bridge when I cross it, to putting my hand in a hand blender." In a hand blender? Oh, a hand blender. I really visualize the thing happening too, and it makes me feel sick. The worst are the ones to do with my dog, who I love with all my heart. I get these uncomfortable thoughts, which I am horrified by, like her falling out of a window. I know rationally that I do not want to or even whatever act on these, but they are there like a compulsion. I would love to know better ways to manage them aside from just acknowledging them and trying to distract myself with something else. End of email. Yeah. So first off, anonymous patron, it's great that you have an accurate conceptualization of it. You are constructing it as an intrusive thought instead of that you're evil or that you're suicidal or something. This is a compulsive, intrusive thought and causes a lot of anxiety. It's very common. And there are ways to manage it and to deal with it. One being to acknowledge them as you're doing and possibly to distract yourself, which sounds like you're also doing. The other thing to do, there's a lot of strategies. One is in addition to what you're doing. Obviously, there's therapy that focuses on compulsions and OCD, because what you're suffering from is very common. There's a lot of reasons that one could address, and I'll just rattle them off the top of my head. One is that you might have compulsive, intrusive thoughts in certain situations. There might be factors that lead to them, and if you manage them better, like stress or something. So if you address those earlier on, you might actually not have as many intrusive thoughts. There's also medication that can be highly effective for this. So you absolutely, if it's really degrading your life, and it sounds like it is, you absolutely should consult with psychiatrists and follow their advice or consider their advice about possible medications for this. And from my understanding, the medications for this are pretty low stakes, meaning that they don't carry with them a tremendous amount of side effects. So you have that going for you potentially. So consult with a specialist psychiatrist along these lines. So there are many other ways to address your OCD other than just acknowledging and distracting, for sure. So seek out appropriate help. All right, this next email is from upper tier patron Kim from Arizona. She writes, "Why does psychological diagnosing take such a long time? In your 90-day fiancé videos, you will frequently analyze a cast member and use their behavior as an example of a potential mental health condition like a personality disorder, etc. But you always follow it up with saying something like, 'I cannot diagnose this person. I would have to have a week's worth of sessions before I could actually diagnose them.'" So just chime in here. Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that, Kim. When I am watching these shows, sometimes I will say, that could be preoccupied attachment, could be schizotypal personality disorder, could be mania, could be this, could be that, could be that. But I want to be clear, I'm not diagnosing them because I would need to assess them and there's not enough data on the show to know anything about these people. I'm just saying, you know, what an hypothesis I might have if I were to know this about someone as I was treating them. And so then you go on to say, Kim, can you explain what that is to you? What would you be looking for in these sessions that would confirm or disprove your hypothetical diagnosis, especially when the signs are overwhelmingly there to a non-psychologist? So just chiming in here, it sounds like, Kim, what you're saying is that when you're watching 90 Day Fiancé, you are saying that the signs of a diagnosis are overwhelmingly being presented by the show. And yeah, I mean, to some extent, there are times when I'm at least strongly I'm strongly imagining that if I were to treat the person, I would quickly have an hypothesis about a conceptualization regarding their diagnosis pretty quickly, because the signs are all there and it's not that hard to apply a label in those situations. So yeah, sometimes. But a lot of the time, I'm legitimately saying that because with especially personality disorders, you really have to assess people in a variety of ways over time, and you have to know that the client is being upfront with you about what their experience is. You know, like with borderline, for example, I really need to hear from the client what their reasoning is behind their behavior. And what I'm looking for them to confirm to me that they worry about being abandoned and or worry about being betrayed profoundly, frequently, constantly. When I hear something like that, I might even just ask those questions. Then, and I've had all the red flags leading up to that, then I have a firm idea of what's going on. So sometimes I have to get their trust so that they can even, you know, answer questions like that. And the way that I operate as a therapist, it's not imperative that I land on a very firm diagnosis early on, because, you know, I'm in private practice, so it's not important. There are some milieus where you have to figure it out very quickly, like in a hospital, in a emergency room, you might literally just have 5 minutes as an evaluator to diagnose someone, so you got to come up with it right away, or if insurance is breathing on your neck, you know. So I have that luxury. If I worked in a different sort of job, and I have in the past, I have a different approach where I will diagnose someone a lot quicker based on more limited information because I have to. Now, I would never just haphazardly diagnose someone, of course, but the way I describe my diagnosing process is longer than typical because of the luxury I have in my practice. Anyway, you go on to say, I ask because I am someone who has been trying to find care for myself for years, and it's been like pulling teeth to get someone to tell me the truth about what I'm experiencing. I saw my last therapist for over 2 years, and it wasn't until our last session that I begged him into giving me a diagnosis, which was schizotypal personality disorder, before kicking me out of the door. Why does it take so long when, to a layperson, it is so obvious right off the bat? End of email. Well, first off, Kim, I want to tell you that I'm sorry you went through that. Sounds like you didn't have a great relationship with your therapist. Also sounds like you were terminated, and you say kicked out of the, you know, out of the office. And so, you know, I'm sorry that you went through that. You deserve a therapeutic relationship that will be beneficial to you and will be sustainable over time. And, you know, I don't know what the problem was there, but you deserve that. And also, you deserve to have a therapist. You know, I don't know what went down, Kim, with your therapist, but if I was, and this happens, you know, occasionally, it doesn't usually happen, but it happens occasionally where, you know, I'll be slowly assessing someone over time and I have some main hypotheses about what's going on. And it doesn't, you know, a lot of times it doesn't involve anything in the DSM. It's more of schema base or attachment base or this kind of thing. But regardless, if a client, which again happens rarely, but happens, let's say I'm midway through that assessment process. It's, you know, say it's like the fifth session and the client asks, so what do you think I have? Like you've been listening to me a lot. What's going on with me? Do you think I have this disorder? Do you think I have that disorder? You know, 99.9% of the time, I'm going to absolutely have that conversation with them because I hate it when I hear about clients having your experience where they don't know what's in the clinician's mind. Clients deserve to know what is in our minds. Now, you could argue there are certain treatment types like traditional psychoanalysis that really dictate that the client doesn't know what's in your mind. Okay, fine. But you have to disclose that earlier on so the client understands that's your style of therapy. But barring that, clients have an ethical right to understand what your treatment plan is and what your assessment is, because it's just a right. It's understood. It's in our ethical codes, informed consent, the whole thing. Treatment, treating clients with respect, being competent. And you can't demonstrate competence without telling the client what you think the issue is that they need to be working on, you know, and it could be a collaborative process. It should be a collaborative process with the client, but they deserve to know. And I hear, you know, not often, but I hear enough about clients will be like, you know, what's my diagnosis? And the therapist will refuse to answer. And I'm like, I just want to yell at these therapists and say, you understand that that's in the client record. And by law, the client has access to that and should have access to that. At the very least, like, what are you afraid of? Like, just tell the client what's going on. Now, occasionally, you know, 0.1% of the time, it's actually not a good idea to tell the client. You know, I can think of a client one time that I was actually afraid of and was getting really hostile. And I started to diagnose him with a few different things. And he was threatening me and demanding that I tell him things. And I calculated that I should be very careful about how I word things to him because I was in danger. I thought he was going to hurt me or burn my house down or something. And so in that situation, I strategically disclosed only what I thought he should know, but also I disclosed only what I thought would, I didn't disclose things to him that I thought would actually cause him to hurt me. And I have that right. Okay. That's very rare. So I doubt that was your situation, Kim. But yeah, I mean, the way you describe it, you know, I saw my last therapist for over 2 years, and it wasn't until our last session that I begged him into giving me a diagnosis. Now, it's possible that your therapist didn't orient themselves towards diagnosing people and just literally didn't have a diagnosis for you. And you thought that they did, and they were hiding it from you when they might not have been. And then when you pushed it, your therapist was just like, well, okay, I guess if I have to apply something, even though that's not my style, I guess I'll say you're schizotypal, okay? So, you know, I don't know the situation. It's hard to say. But you, from my discussions on 90 Day Fiancé, you're getting the impression that I might be kind of like your therapist, and I don't think I am. If someone literally asked me half an hour into our first session, they'd be like, well, what do you think I have? And I detected that it was really important for them to know, I'd tell them. I'd be like, well, you have signs of this. I've heard this. I think this is an hypothesis here. We need to explore it more, but I'm hearing that. I'll tell you everything that's in my head. And because I do that. I do that a lot with my clients. I just say, I'm just going to tell you everything that's rattling around in my head. And it's the following three things. And I'll tell you why these things are rattling around in my head, you know, because I just want you to know so that you can tell me if I'm right or wrong and you can think about it and you can be informed about what sort of treatment you're getting, because what I'm going to do to you is based on these thoughts, but I need to know from you if it makes any sense, these thoughts. So I do that all the time. And Kim, you deserve a therapist. If that's a style that you want, you deserve a therapist that would do that too. So when I say on 90 Day Fiancé, it takes me a long time, I'm not saying that I would withhold from a client what's in my mind. I might say to a client, well, I don't know what diagnosis you have because I don't have enough information, but I'll tell you what sort of hypotheses I'm developing that are prompting me to want more information. You know, it's these, I'm thinking these three things, but honestly, I don't know what's going on here because I'm hearing a lot of different information. You know, I'll just tell a client that because, you know, it's just my style. And there's a lot of therapists that have that style. All right, patrons, love you so much. Thank you for being a patron, and enjoy your weekend and take care of yourself. Truly, 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 take care of yourself. Take care of others. Get other people to take care of you because you deserve it. You really, really do.